you. It's good to be here with some of the great business failures of the San Francisco area. I was sitting at a table with Jay Mitchell, who probably many of you know. Some of you may not know that he is here this morning with a broken rib. He was on the ski slopes, although not actually on the skis. He was in a saucer, and which is a very dangerous thing, you know, being in a saucer. High-risk activity, so he has had no sympathy. He would enjoy a moment of sympathy from all of you for being here. But not a hug. Yeah, that's right. Come up to him afterwards. That's right. Anybody but me notice that the pace of life seems to be accelerating lately? Citicorp became leading institution in lending because they said that they would make things available in 15 days. Denny's business took off when they made lunch available in 10 minutes. Remember they did that deal where they would bring a little... None of you go to Denny's. Well, if you went to Denny's, you would know. I go to Denny's all the time. They brought a little clock to your table. 10 minutes. They would get you lunch. Pert Plus became the number one selling shampoo in America because it offered shampoo and conditioner all in the same step. No more of those lengthy showers where you have to do the shampoo thing and then the conditioner thing. Now you do it all at once. Domino's Pizza became the nation's leading seller of pizzas because they would get you a pizza in 30 minutes or less, and they took it very seriously. According to one article in 1988, there were something like 20 traffic fatalities involving Domino's Pizza drivers. You all followed the story this last year, the settlement that a jury awarded a woman's family $79 million because of a traffic problem involving a Domino's pizza delivery guy. I read one article about it was an interview with a Domino's guy, and he said when he drives and puts the Domino sign out on his car, cars on the road pull over. This is serious. Like they used to do for ambulances, you know? That's right. I mean, when I was a kid, people would pull over if there was an ambulance on the road. They don't do that anymore. People do not pull over for ambulances today. They pull over for Domino's pizza delivery guys. Tells you something about our society. Major shopping center chain is experimenting with grocery carts, grocery shopping carts that have video monitors on them to tell everybody where all the items they're looking for are located. Video monitor shopping carts. They still can't get the wheels on the things to work, but video monitors on them. Faxes, ATM machines, microwaves. Microwave technology is interesting. Over 80% of all American homes now have microwaves. When they first came out, they used to have a lot of microwave products that were done in two steps. You would do a first step microwave thing, then open the door, take the lid off, do the second step. They don't do that anymore. You know why? Too many complaints. It took too much time. So now it's just one step for microwave things. Anxiety is increasing as a mental health problem. In fact, it has now replaced depression as what is called the common cold of the emotional life. In California, stress-related job disability claims were up over 500% in a single decade. In a recent survey of working women, they asked women, thousands of women, if you had one extra hour in the day, what would you do with it? Sleep. That's right. Somebody over here, ready to go right now. My guess is that there are probably some busy people in this room. Very possibly some closet workaholics. We're talking about pace of life issues and workaholism today. So we're going to do a mass confession. We do this every once in a while at the church where I come from, and I'm going to just run through a series of things, and if you can confess, if you can endorse any of these items, I'm going to ask you just to raise your hand. To actually raise your hand. You know, you won't see these people again for a month, so don't worry about it. If you can really endorse it, you may want to stand up. You may want to just stand up. Confession is good for the soul. All right, first category here is hurry. For you who are in a hurry, there are not enough hours in the day. You come to a stoplight. If there's two lanes, you find yourself immediately looking to see, you know, if there's a car in each lane, which car is faster? Hang on a second. Don't raise your hands yet. Yeah, that's right. You people are in a hurry. You're saying, all right, get on with it. On to the next category. If you end up in a store, you know, you immediately scan all the aisles to see which line is going to get through the cash register in the fastest. You are what's called polyphasic. that is you need to do more than one thing at one time. Drive a car, listen to the radio, talk on the car phone, use the turn signal, gesture, you know, all of those things simultaneously. All right, now, how many of you could say, yeah, I hurry? How many of you find yourself there? Okay, all right. Second category, some of you will wrestle with, very possibly many who wrestle with the first one, you find yourself needing control, wanting to be in control. Your motto is, if you want to do something right, you got to do it yourself. Now, I, as a pastor, do a lot of weddings, and weddings, typically, there's one person in the wedding party who is big on wanting to be in control, and that person is mother of the bride. It's amazing the amount of control they feel a need to exert in a wedding. I was in one wedding one time where the mother of the bride said to me, if you can't get a better looking pair of shoes, I'm going to replace you. And that was my mother-in-law. That was in my wedding. Anybody here into control? Mass confession? All right. How about perfectionism? Perfectionism. Now, if you're a perfectionist, you don't want to raise your hand because you know everybody is going to be looking at you, thinking about you, and you don't want them to go home and say, you know, this guy's a perfectionist. Perfectionists often have a tendency to think that their work is their worth. I've got a quote here from a writer who includes a quote from Irma Bombeck. Talks about people that deal with perfectionism in the home. Has some recommendations for people that are a little too perfectionistic about their house. Go ahead and leave stuff out, this guy writes. There's nothing sacred about always putting things away. If you find yourself in a hide-the-stuff panic when there's an unexpected knock at the door, you probably just have too much stuff. Maybe your visitor could take some of your stuff when he or she leaves. Leave your stuff out as a sort of perpetual estate sale for visitors to shop through. Take some stuff off your hand. Write the word joy in the dust on the table sometimes. Dust is only a process of small particle rearrangements. Irma Bombeck said that she would like the following line on her tombstone. Big deal. I'm used to dust. Any perfectionists here? Give you one more category. How many of you would confess that you're into criticism? You tend to evaluate. You tend to go through life as if the world is a movie and you are Siskel and Ebert. Your job is to judge other people's performance. How many of you would say, going to be really honest now, mass confession, how many of you would say, I can be critical. How many of you have discovered criticism is your spiritual gift? We live in a world where increasingly people rush through life. People rush through life. And we see interesting trends in our day. On the one hand, people invest themselves terribly heavy in their career and accomplishing. I live in Southern California, a land where people commute. They just commute. And then they come home, and like in the old days when castles had moats and drawbridges, we have kind of an analogous thing. People come home, and we all have garage door openers, and they raise the drawbridge and drive in, and then cocoon inside the home, collapse. And they just kind of go from commuting to cocooning. And rush through life. Little boy was confused because every day his dad came home carrying a briefcase. And the boy asked his father, Dad, how come you always come home with your work? And his dad says, well, I can't get it all done at the office, so I have to bring it home with me. And the boy says, well, Dad, couldn't they put you in a slower group? Works in school. I just take Dad out of the bluebirds, put him into the crows, you know, that kind of a deal. Jesus wanted a way to address the tendency that people have to waste their lives. It happens differently in different cultures. This form it tends to take in our culture, but he wanted to address people that tend to do that. And so, as he typically would, he told a story. And I want to paraphrase it a bit. I want to tell it to you the way that I think Jesus might tell it if he were speaking to this group. But the way that he told it is printed in your programs, and you can look at it later on if you'd like to. It's from the Gospel of Luke, the 12th chapter. It's the story of a workaholic. This guy was an entrepreneur. Now, he knew what the odds are. He knew that most new businesses fail within the first 5 years. Only 4% of them continue to exist 10 years down the road. But he was committed. He was willing to do anything it would take, and it took everything. He found himself consumed by his work. 12, 14-hour work days, worked on weekends, joined professional organizations, boards of directors in order to expand his contacts. Even when he was not working, he found his mind drifting towards work, so that it was not only his occupation, it became his preoccupation. His wife often tried to slow him down, to remind him that he had a family. He was vaguely aware of the fact that his kids were growing up and he was missing it. From time to time, they would complain and ask him to read books or play games of catch or have lunch with them. But after enough time passed, you know, they got used to the fact that it was not going to happen. He would say to himself sometimes, "I'll become more available to my family in 6 months or so, when things settle down." And although he was a very bright guy, this guy in Jesus' story, he never seemed to notice that things didn't settle down. One morning at 1 o'clock in the morning, he felt a twinge of pain in his chest. His wife made an appointment with the doctors, who told him he'd had a very slight heart condition, and they warned him that all of the symptoms were there: high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol, and he needed to have some changes in his lifestyle. And for a while he did. He joined a health club, got on an exercise program, stopped eating so much red meat and Twinkies, learned how to do biofeedback. But when the symptoms decreased, his motivation decreased. And he said he'll get back into a healthy program when he's got more time, when things settle down. He recognized that his life was out of balance. His wife tried to talk him into going to church. There was one just down the street. He intended to do it someday, but Sunday morning seemed to be the only time that he could crash. "Besides," he said, "I have plenty of opportunity to believe in God without having to go to church. I will go when things settle down." One day, some people in the cash flow department of his company came to see him. And they said, "You're not going to believe this, but business is booming such that we cannot keep up. We're on the brink of a miracle. This is the mother lode. We have a chance to catch it. And if we catch this wave, we're set for life. But we need to make some changes. We've got inventory headaches that you would not believe, and the orders are coming in so fast that supply is outstripping demand in our company. Our software is hopelessly outdated. If we don't overhaul everything from top to bottom, we're headed for disaster." And from that time on, he was like a man consumed. From that time on, every waking moment was devoted to this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And then it hit him. He would put his company through a technological revolution. Attach modems to car phones for all their employees. Put fax machines in the washrooms. 24-hour online contact with all of their clients. Completely rebuild things. And he said to his wife that night, "You know what this means," he said. "When I get through with this project, we can relax." He said, "Our future is assured, and we'll be set for life. I know the market. I've covered every base. I've anticipated every contingency. We will have achieved financial security. Now we can go on that vacation you've been pestering me about for so long." But she'd heard that sort of thing before. And she had learned not to get her hopes up. And at 11 o'clock that night, she headed upstairs to the bedroom by herself because he said he wanted to work on his idea for just a couple of minutes. "You go ahead," he said. "I'll be there in just a couple of minutes." At 3 o'clock in the morning, she woke up and he was still not in bed. "This is ridiculous," she said to herself. "It's like being married to a child. Doesn't even want to come to bed." So she went downstairs and saw him with his back to her in front of his computer monitor, his head slumped down on his arm. And she touched him on the shoulder to wake him up, to bring him up to bed. But he did not respond. And his skin was cold when she touched it. And she got a sick feeling in the pit of her stomach. And she dialed 911, but by the time the paramedics got there, he had been dead for some hours. His death was a major story in the financial community. His obituary was written up in Business Weekly and Forbes and the Wall Street Journal, and it's too bad he was dead because he would have loved to read what they all wrote about him. And then it was time for his memorial service, and because of his prominence, the whole community was there, and everybody filed past his casket, and they made the same comment that people always make at funerals. He looked so peaceful. Rigor mortis does that to you. We used to say, when I was in junior high, death is nature's way of telling you to slow down. And there's more truth in that than most of us realize. People got up to eulogize this man. He was one of the leading entrepreneurs of his day. He was an inventor, an innovator in technology and delivery systems, said another. He was a man of principles, somebody else said. He was a straight arrow kind of guy. He would never cheat on his taxes, his expense account, or his wife. Another noted all of his civic achievements. He was a pillar in the community. He knew everybody. That man was a networker. And they put up a memorial to him, and they wrote inspiring words on it. Entrepreneur, innovator, leader, visionary, pillar, success. And they buried him, and they put up the memorial, and they went home. And then when it was dark, and no one was present to see or to hear, unobserved, the angel of God came to the cemetery and made his way past all of the other tombstones and came to this man's memorial and traced with a finger the single word that God used to summarize this man's life. Next to all of those other words, entrepreneur, leader, visionary, pillar, innovator, success, the single word that God chose to summarize this man's life. Know what it was? Fool. Fool. God said, you fool. Then why? Why this kind of harsh language? I mean, we don't even let our kids use that word. Why does Jesus do this? I believe that he is not engaged in name-calling. He is involved in a tragically accurate diagnosis. For all of this guy's entrepreneurial acumen, for all of his cost-benefits analysis and cash flow projections, what is the one scenario that he forgot to account for in his forecast? It was death. He forgot that he was going to die. And God stands amazed at the folly of a human being who painstakingly prepares for every contingency, covers every base, no matter how unlikely, and forgets the one inevitable certainty that stares all of us in the face, that we're going to die. He neglected to plan for the most obvious and predictable event of human existence. What other word could you use to describe behavior like that? So busy building his own kingdom, he had no time for the kingdom of God. So busy making a living, he had no time to make a life. What other word are you going to use? Now, there's two great illusions that I think were involved in this guy's life that I think it would be wise for us to look at in our culture. The first one is this guy believed that he would get around to what's important when things settled down. Let me ask you folks a question. When do things settle down? When you die. Things really settle down when you die. His other great illusion, first one was that someday things will settle down. Other great illusion was, if I keep getting more, if I keep doing more, if I keep acquiring more, one day I will cross the magic line from more to enough. More never, 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 never leads to enough. Doesn't happen. Great illusion was that more would lead him to enough. In the Bible, there's a verse written by the Apostle Paul, and he says in one place, I have learned the secret of being content in every circumstance. In other words, contentment is a learned skill. It is not the product of appropriate kind of circumstances. You will never get to a set of circumstances that will create contentment for you. If you become content, it will be generated from the inside. I remember a cartoon one time with Snoopy, you know Snoopy from Charlie Brown? Snoopy is laying on top of his doghouse, and it's Thanksgiving, and he's kind of complaining because everybody else is inside having turkey and cranberry and so on, and he's stuck with dog food. And he's complaining about that for a while, and then he kind of pauses to reflect philosophically, and he says, well, it could be worse. I could have been born a turkey. I want you to take that little phrase with you. It could be worse. In fact, it'd be good for all of us to say it together. Let's say it together. It could be worse. When you leave here, you're going to get in your car. You're going to see somebody else's car that's nicer, that's newer, that's more expensive. And there's going to be part of you that says, if I had that person's car, I would be content. Instead, I want you to say, when you get into your car, with some passion, with some passion, when you go home tonight, you're going to walk into your house or your apartment, and you're going to think about somebody else's house, which is nicer, bigger, newer. And you're going to think, if I lived in that home, I would be content. But it's not true. So I want you to say to yourself with some passion, it could be worse. When you wake up tomorrow morning and roll over and look at your spouse, no, don't do it. Don't do it. I heard a psychologist some time ago talk about an analogy that has always stayed with me, that I think gets after what Jesus was trying to say. Reminded me of a game that I used to play with my grandmother. You all know the game Monopoly? My grandmother taught me how to play the game. She was a wonderful woman. She raised 6 children, 3 boys and 3 girls. By the time that I knew her, she was a widow, a very devout follower of Jesus. But the most ruthless Monopoly player that I think I've ever known. Picture what would happen if Donald Trump married Leona Helmsley, and you get some idea. My grandmother. The name of the game, as she played it, was to acquire. When I first started playing, I would get my money from the bank, and I'd want to save it. I'd want to hold on to it. But she knew that you had to accumulate. So she would spend everything, and then when she bought stuff, she'd mortgage it to buy more. And she would eventually become the master of the board. She knew that money was how you keep score in this game. That what you possess is the difference between winning and losing. It's about survival. And she would say to me, as she beat me consistently, one day you'll learn, she would say. When I was 10 or 11, I met a friend who lived behind our house, and we played Monopoly every day, all summer long. And gradually, as it played, it began to dawn on me that the only way to beat my grandmother would be to make a total commitment to acquisition. That summer, I learned how to play the game. In the fall, we went for a vacation to a cabin up in Wisconsin, and my grandmother went with us, and I was more ruthless than she was. I was ready to bend the rules if I needed to. My palms were sweaty. Slowly, cunningly, I exposed the soft underbelly of my grandmother's weakness. Ruthlessly, inexorably, I drove her off the board. The game does strange things to you. I can still remember it happened on Marvin Gardens. I looked at my grandmother. She taught me how to play. She was by now an old lady. This is the woman who had raised my mother. She was a widow. She loved me. I took everything she had. I destroyed her not only financially, but psychologically. I watched her give me her last dollar and quit in utter defeat. It was the greatest moment of my life. And then she had one more thing to teach me. She said to me, now it all goes back in the box. All of the houses, and all the hotels, Boardwalk and Park Place, and the utilities, and all the money, it all goes back in the box. I didn't want it to go back in the box. I wanted to just leave the board out for a long time, maybe bronze it and enjoy what I had acquired. It all goes back in the box, she said. It's not mine, not really mine. It was just a game. I don't really own any of it. And the next time around, somebody else will play the game, and all these things that are mine today, tomorrow, will belong to somebody else. He was a shrewd guy, this man in Jesus' story. He learned to play the game, and he played it well. He was the master of the board. But he forgot one thing. The game would end. The game always ends. Sooner or later, it all goes back in the box. It happens to everybody. Businessman is out jogging, experiences a sudden sharp pain, and his chest feels like it's about to burst open, and in an instant, everything goes back in the box. Car drives, and the driver misses a stop sign, and in an instant, everything goes back in the box. You go into a doctor's office, and he tells you it's malignant, and you lay in a hospital bed, and in an instant, it all goes back in the box. Houses and cars, titles and clothes, all the toys go back in the box. Filled barns and bulging portfolios, even your body. And you have to ask yourself the question, what matters? What was worth giving my life to? If you don't ask that question, what other word are you going to use to describe that kind of life? Now, the story that Jesus told has been lived out millions of times. You don't even have to believe the Bible. You see it every day. And you may be here this morning and you may be kind of searching things out. You may not nearly be ready to say, simply because the Bible says something, it doesn't mean that I have to believe it. You see this story every day. It's from an article I read some time ago. He wanted more money, so he parlayed inherited wealth into a $1 billion pile of assets. He wanted more fame, so he broke into the Hollywood scene and soon became a filmmaker and star. He wanted more sensual pleasure, so he paid handsome sums to indulge his every sexual urge. He wanted more thrills, so he designed, built, and piloted the fastest aircraft in the world. He wanted more power, so he secretly dealt political favors so skillfully that 2 U.S. presidents became his pawns. All he ever wanted was more. He was absolutely convinced that more would bring him true satisfaction. Unfortunately, history shows otherwise. You know how this man concluded his life? Emaciated, colorless, sunken chest, fingernails in grotesque inches-long corkscrews. Rotting black teeth, tumors, innumerable needle marks from his drug addiction. Howard Hughes died a billionaire junkie. Insane by all reasonable standards. Let me ask you a question. Do you think if he'd have closed one more deal, made one more billion, experienced one more thrill, think that would have been enough? She was the most adulated of women. Every woman envied her. Every man wanted her. She had beauty, money, fame, power. She died alone. She died at her own hand. If Marilyn Monroe had had one more hit movie, one more magazine cover, one more sexual relationship with a powerful man, do you think that would have been enough? My wife enjoys shopping. Do you think if I were to say to her, you know, go for an hour to Nordstrom's, here's the credit card, any dress in the store, any shoes, any hat, jewelry, necklace, accessories, for an hour, think that'd make her happy? Well, we'll never know, will we? How far do you have to walk down this road, Jesus said, before you see where it leads? Surely you understand it will never be enough. You don't have to even believe the Bible. You see it every day. There was a short story written by Tolstoy. It's called Much Land. It's the story of a peasant who, through a series of circumstances, is enabled to acquire land. And then a better parcel, and a better parcel, and a better parcel. Although he has to kind of sell his life to get it, and give up his family to get it. Finally, he hears about a village where the people are apparently incredibly naive, and they will give you as much land as you want. So he goes there. And the mayor of this little village says, in the morning, start from a certain point and walk all day, and as much land as you can walk around in a day can belong to you. You just have to come back to the place where you started. You need to put 1,000 rubles in a hat, and if you don't make it back, you lose the money, but as long as you make it back, that whole plot of land can be yours. And the peasant is amazed. He says, you can walk around a great deal of land in a day. And the mayor says, nevertheless, it can all be yours. Guy can't sleep all night. The morning, he's up on this knoll at the crack of dawn. There's a group of townspeople there with the mayor, and he puts 1,000 rubles into the hat. And he starts to walk, and a strange thing happens in Tolstoy's story. As this guy walks, he sees a plot of land, and he thinks to himself, you know, that'd be a great plot. I need to expand my walk a little bit so I can get that. Sees another patch of ground that he hadn't originally intended on having, but he says it'd be a great place to grow wheat, so I must have that. And he walks farther and farther and farther and farther, and finally stops to have lunch, and by this time it's into the afternoon, and he realizes that the day is more than half gone and he's got to start back. So he does. But the sun starts getting lower faster than he had anticipated. And he says, no more time now to turn aside and to get additional plots. I've got to head straight back. But it's getting later and later. So he starts going faster and faster, and it's a warm day, and by this time his coat's off and his vest is off, and he begins to run. And the thought occurs to him, I might not make it back. So he runs faster. His heart's pounding. His lungs are wheezing like bellows. There are pains shooting through his body. His feet feel like knives are cutting into them. His body is racked. And he realizes that this race back is killing him. But the strangest thing is, he can't stop himself. Can't bring himself to stop. Because he said, I'd look like such a fool if I stop. Finally, he comes into a clearing and he sees the people up on the knoll. And when he gets to the bottom of the little hill, the sun goes down and he thinks he's lost his chance forever. But he plunges up the hill, and because they're set up on the hill, they still see a few beams of sunlight. And so he stumbles across the top of the hill, falls down, and with his hand reaches out and touches the hat. His servant is up on the knoll. The servant runs to him and helps him to turn over. And as he does that, he sees that his master is dead. And the mayor of the village laughs and throws the servant a shovel. And the people walk down from the knoll. You know how much land the guy ends up with? 6 feet. Nature has its own land redistribution program, more radical by far than the most radical of Marxist governments. You know how much we all get? 6 feet. It all goes back in the box. It all goes back in the box. All workaholism is a form of denial. The fundamental reality that workaholics deny is that we're going to die. There is a simple two-word question that workaholics tend not to ask, and the question is, then what? This is the question that the guy in Jesus' story never asks. He thought his problem was he had too much stuff and not enough closet space. And his assumption was that his wealth would last, he just needs a place to put it. And he never thought to ask himself, when I have enough, when the barns are full, when I've achieved financial security, then what? Jesus says, you got to ask yourself, when you finally get the ultimate promotion, when you've made the ultimate purchase, bought the ultimate home, when you have reached financial security and climbed the ladder of success to the highest rung that it can be climbed, and the thrill wears off, and the thrill will wear off, then what? What do you do with a cold marriage or none at all and children who learned early on that they are not as important as a briefcase and a meeting and a barn full of stuff? How important can all that stuff be? Don't you understand, God asks, how quickly life passes? Don't you understand it all goes back in the box? Understand, it's not a bad man in Jesus' story. He's not grossly immoral. He is respected in the community. He just had one problem. He was too busy. He was too busy. That was really his only problem. He was too busy. Ask him about any of the things that he would say represent ultimate value, and his answer to you would be, I will get around to those things one of these days. Right now, I'm too busy. But see, the Bible says that we are immortal creatures destined for eternity. The Bible says that someday we'll stand before God, and God will say, I gifted you for serving me, for worshiping me, for deep relationships, for intimacy, for giving. Why did you not do these things? What are we going to say? Too busy. God will say, too busy doing what? Didn't you know that life was about more than building bigger barns? Didn't you know that it would all go back in the box? If I am not equipped to deal with ultimate realities of life, if I have not developed an understanding of life and integrated a value system that takes into account the fact that I'm going to die, I'm not ready to live. It doesn't matter how much I accumulate. It all goes back in the box. It all goes back in the box.